Imagine, if you will, a political ad. I know, that is a lot to ask, but will you give it a try? Imagine that this particular political ad is about job creation. Where does a politician go when they want to talk about creating more jobs? What is the archetypical setting for a political ad about creating new jobs? This ad doesn't have images of high-rise office buildings. It doesn't have an image of an insurance agency storefront in an office park. That ad doesn't feature the local restaurant downtown that's had a now hiring sign emblazoned across its front doors for the last 3 years, because it seems they're always hiring. No, I'm willing to bet that political ad you just envisioned was at a factory. Maybe your imaginary political ad sounds a little like this one, which, I shit you not, was the first result in a Google search for political ad about job creation.
It's about investing in places and people that have been forgotten. It's about making things here in America again. It's about good jobs. It's about the dignity of work. And it's about damn time we're doing it.
Joe Biden is determined to reward hard work. That's why he passed historic laws that rebuild our roads and bridges, invest in our factories, and bring back American manufacturing. Over 12 million.
When a politician wants us to think of them as a job creator, they use the factory as a metaphor. That's capital T, capital F, by the way. The factory. It's almost like jobs get produced on an assembly line of public policy. The factory, capital T, capital F, is an outdated metaphor for work today, if that wasn't already obvious. But that metaphor still informs how we think about work and what we expect from ourselves as workers. Productivity, efficiency, standardization, automation, output. We often rely on concepts that govern industrial and manufacturing process management to describe work that defies the very definition of those terms. When we try to squeeze creative, knowledge-based service or care work into the mental model of the factory, we create confounding and stressful working conditions for ourselves and often for others. So why does the metaphor of the factory, capital T, capital F, still permeate our disposition toward work, our very image of what a job is? I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show that rethinks work, business, and leadership for the 21st century economy. Today's episode is about why trying to squeeze creative knowledge and service work into the metaphor of the factory doesn't work. And to do that, we're going to closely examine why this kind of work can be so deceptively intense, frustrating, and confusing. But before we get into the rest of today's episode, I want to invite you to Rethink Work, a new cohort-based course that I'm teaching starting on February 22nd. During our 8 weeks together, we'll rethink beliefs about work-life balance, productivity, data, passion, purpose, and the path to success. I designed this course to reveal brick by brick how our beliefs about work and our identities as workers create the work reality we exist in, so that we can tear those bricks down and build something better. You'll gain both the critical framework you need to notice outdated beliefs and apply those frameworks to make practical changes to the way you work every day. To get all the details, go to rethinkwork.club or click the link in the show notes. That's rethinkwork.club. Now, I've never worked on an assembly line, but I can picture one, and I'm sure you can too. I can easily imagine what that kind of job would entail, which is not to say that kind of job is easy or desirable, just very imaginable. However, I have no idea what the average architect or home health aide's job is like. I've eaten in plenty of restaurants, but I don't really know how the job of a server or line cook works. I ostensibly work full-time as a writer, but the daily work of other writers is basically a black box to me. In other words, the factory, capital T, capital F, lacks the inherent ambiguity and uncertainty of more 21st century modes of work. We want metaphors that translate easily across different groups of people. I can have the perfect metaphor for some complex topic, but if my metaphor isn't recognizable to you, it doesn't work. But the factory is easily recognizable. It's easily parsed by all sorts of different people. That said, the factory, capital T, capital F, is an abstraction. What I think of when I think of an assembly line or manufacturing workshop is different from what factories are really like. And so, the metaphor itself becomes a blueprint for reality. The goals I set for my work are built according to this blueprint. My expectations for how I perform are directed by this blueprint. The challenges I face and the solutions I seek to create are based on the logic of this blueprint. As time goes by, though, I get frustrated because the blueprint I'm working with doesn't actually match what I'm trying to make. It's like trying to build a Billy bookshelf with the instructions for a Malm bed frame. The parts don't match, the steps make no sense, and I just can't figure out how this bed frame is supposed to organize all my books. All right, hopefully you got that one, but I'm mixing metaphors now. That frustration, that confusion, is at the heart of so many of the problems we face with work today. Setting aside the economic, political, and cultural issues that vex our working lives, a big ask, again, I know, the mental model we have for work is just wrong. Let's make this frustration and confusion more concrete by looking at three specific types of work. Management researcher and theorist Armand Hatchewal labels our frustration and confusion work intensity. He argues that work intensity functions differently for different types of work. That means that different types of work need different strategies for mitigating or combating work intensity. To figure that part out, Hatchewal offers three factors of work intensity: definition, design, and stability. Now, those are my labels. Hatchewal's labels were actually prescriptions, design, and confinement, respectively. But I'll humbly submit that my labels are a little clearer. So the definition of a job is the set of rules, requirements, knowledge, and objectives that give it shape. The design of a job is the policies and procedures put in place to limit the bounds of the job and reduce the mental load it requires. The stability of a job is the amount of fluctuation the worker can expect in the job's tasks and responsibilities from day to day. So another way to think about this is that the definition of a job is sort of inherent to that job itself. The design of a job, on the other hand, is put in place by management, and the relative stability or instability of a job occurs over time. It's a function of time in the task. Hatchewal illustrates these aspects through describing three types of work: factory work, bus driving, and creative or knowledge-based work. A factory worker's job is highly defined, highly designed, and highly stable. The archetypical factory worker shows up to a day at work knowing exactly what their job is, how to complete that job, and what the rules around that job are. Management creates training, policies, and procedures to limit the job and reduce its mental load. And management further controls all work conditions, equipment, raw materials, schedule, location, etc. So that really is the kind of work that we think of when we think of the factory. Capital T, capital F. Now, a bus driver's job is pretty different. It's still highly defined, but the design and the stability of the job are lower than in the case of a factory worker. While a bus driver still follows a strict schedule, expectations, and rules, the driver has a great deal of autonomy on the road. They can't change the route, but they are responsible for dealing with how passengers and traffic can create unexpected and often unwanted changes in their working conditions. Aside from a radio connection back to dispatch, the bus driver is on their own. Further, sometimes a bus driver's job isn't actually driving the bus at all. Sometimes it's counselor, moderator, knowledgeable citizen, or overdose interrupter. The boundaries of what is and what isn't the job of the bus driver are constantly changing. It's unstable. Now, the example of the bus driver makes me think of my time in retail management, too. The people I managed had relatively defined jobs, especially at a task level. Cashier, barista, bookseller. They received training in how to use all of the tools of the trade, things like cash register, inventory system, espresso machine. We even did our best to train them on how to recommend books, respond to customer questions, and keep an eye out for theft. Unlike the bus driver, they were stuck in our store, but on the floor itself, they were fairly self-directed. I couldn't observe the thought process that went into a customer interaction. I wasn't actively controlling the flow of work in the cafe. As a manager, of course, I had even more autonomy and self-management responsibility, and that meant I had to step in when work design systems failed and the situation got too unstable. I could see the consequences of work intensity on the people I managed and on myself. Now, finally, we arrive at the creative or knowledge worker. This is a big category. These jobs are moderately defined with low design and low stability. Creative and knowledge-based work, as well as service work and care work, is fluid, amorphous, and often ambiguous. Each worker is a sort of node in a system. The connections between nodes are critical, but they're also subject to change at any time. Like the factory worker, the creative or knowledge worker can only do their job if someone else in the chain does theirs. But unlike the factory worker, what each person in the chain does isn't very well defined. So each consecutive person who picks up a widget from the creative assembly line sort of makes it up as they go. One worker builds on or adjusts the widget based on what they know about widgets and how they interpret their role. The next worker takes what that worker's done and builds on or adjusts the widget based on what they know and how they interpret their role. Hatchell argues that this high reliance on others combined with the ambiguity around one's job increases work intensity. Further, adjusting that intensity is a lot more complicated because the work processes involved are often personal and unarticulated rather than physically observable. Now, the creative or knowledge worker also has plenty in common with the bus driver. They both have considerable autonomy or responsibility over their self-management and responses to changes in conditions. However, the bus company can mitigate work intensity for drivers by observing patterns, designing new training, and equipping drivers with new strategies. Since drivers' difficulties on the road are easily observed and defined, the company can create solutions or policies to offer drivers more support and more stability. But the creative or knowledge worker is in a pickle. Workers face novel challenges every day. In fact, they're often tasked with inventing novel challenges, since their jobs revolve around working with new ideas, designs, and solutions, which inevitably create novel challenges. For example, whenever I send out a newsletter, I risk getting something wrong and inspiring an inbox full of unexpected emails, which changes how I spend the rest of my workday. When I post something on social media, I'm creating the potential for a post to go viral, which is pretty destabilizing, even if the results are positive. When one of our podcasting clients logs into a Zoom session with Sean and me, they're often creating unexpected work for themselves just by asking for our opinion on their content. Doing just about anything at all in the realm of creative knowledge or service work can open up a can of worms. Creating training or policies to address this barrage of novelty is nearly impossible. So no matter the intentions and resources of the employer or self-employed person, the work can be deceptively high intensity. That deceptively high intensity is a narrative problem, which is to say that it's a problem with the stories we tell ourselves, which is to say that it's a metaphor problem. We can easily understand why a job at the factory, capital T, capital F, would be stressful. Having your quota go up every month is stressful. We can also easily understand how a bus driver might be regularly frustrated. Having to diffuse potentially dangerous situations is not fun. But the creative or knowledge worker has it easy, right? We're just lucky to have this kind of work to do at all. Well, not so fast. We often downplay our stress or strain because we don't have a way to articulate exactly what is so intense about what we do. To be clear, I'm not saying that factory workers or bus drivers have it easy. I'm not even saying that creative or knowledge workers are in a worse spot. My point is that most of us don't know how to recognize or describe the source of stress and intensity of a job that we might well perceive as fun in the right circumstances. But that lack of recognition or description doesn't change reality. It just makes it harder to deal with. To cope, we often try to turn creative knowledge and service work into something that resembles factory work. That's the power of a foundational metaphor like the factory, capital T, capital F. You can see the influence of the factory on the landing pages for top productivity apps, on book covers, and across YouTube channels. As a result, we talk about automation, productivity, and efficiency. We wring our hands over the details of a process or rule. We decide to have stronger boundaries, to set a reasonable schedule, to take less shit, to unplug. And these objectives can have merit. Well, okay, not the hand-wringing. But I see so many people get down on themselves when they don't follow through on their commitment to a saner working life. The truth is that stabilizing inherently unstable work is a Sisyphean task. Making one aspect of the creative process more efficient will destabilize a different part of the process. Standardizing an element of your job might make you more productive in one area, but will likely destabilize another element of your job. What's more, who honestly believes that optimizing creative knowledge or service work leads to better outcomes? Who believes that innovation happens in assembly line conditions? Who believes that care and service work is best done by adhering to a strict schedule and set of rules? The more we attempt to squeeze creative knowledge and service work into the metaphor of the factory, capital T, capital F, the more likely we are to burn out. Not so much because we're working so very hard, but because how we're trying to work isn't designed to make what we want to make. I want to invite you to Rethink Work, a new cohort-based course that I'm teaching starting on February 22nd. During our 8 weeks together, we'll rethink beliefs about work-life balance, productivity, data, passion, purpose, and the path to success. I designed this course to reveal brick by brick how our beliefs about work and our identities as workers create the work reality we exist in so that we can tear those bricks down and build something better. You'll gain both the critical framework you need to notice outdated beliefs and apply those frameworks to make practical changes to the way you work every day. To get all the details, go to rethinkwork.club or click the link in the show notes. That's rethinkwork.club. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.